Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plot Lines. I'm your host, Connor. And today we're going to be talking about all things Gen Z. We're going to be talking about whether or not the Catholic Church is really drawing in Gen Z. What could the church be doing better? Where are Gen Z actually really drawn specifically to? And is it just the religion? Is it culture surrounding Catholicism? Is it politics related? You know, we're going to talk about that all and more. And today I have with me Nicholas Cavazos, the traditional Thomist. How are you doing, sir?
Doing pretty good. Thanks for having me on. I think this is the first time that we actually just get to chat, because if memory serves, the last time I was on, I was with Anthony and Rob, and it was like the Christmas special or something like that.
It was utterly silly. So this is the first time we'll be talking where it's not, sort of on my channel at least, where it's not a complete, goofy chaos sort of thing. And then I think most of the times that we've been on sort of the podcast previously with On Avoiding Babylon together were, originally their, their trivia show. So mm-hmm. That was also silly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of trivia, which hopefully they'll bring back sooner than later. I think that they said something like, I forget what the number was, but maybe it's like a 15,000 subscriber or something like that special. They'll bring back trivia, something like that.
Yeah, I was told like a month or two ago, being like, are you in for trivia? And I'm like, yeah. And then never heard back. That happened. You are a convert, and so you have the sort of, you were drawn to the Catholic faith probably, in some sense more than I needed to be, because I'm a cradle Catholic. I didn't need to be as drawn to the Catholic Church because I never really left it. So can you tell us a little bit about a short version of your conversion?
Sure. Yeah. I was, it's hard to put a label on myself in a strict sense, because I kind of go back between revert and convert in the sense that I was baptized in the Catholic Church by my father when I was 6 months old or 3 months old, excuse me. However, it was immediately after that he left. And so, no upbringing at all. It was, I think I was 12 before I even found out that I was baptized in the Catholic faith. I mean, it was seriously that much of a gap, if you will, in that educational realm, and grew up in non-denominationalism and evangelicalism, kind of just mainstream, typical American South evangelicalism. Got a love for the Bible at a really young age. I had kind of had a knack for competitive Bible verse memory contests and things along that nature. So I was always kind of drawn in some form or fashion to theology. It was around the age of, I would say, maybe 9 or 10 that I actually started to read books on theology. They were, of course, age appropriate for that level, kind of theological church history books that you'd find in my particular homeschooling curriculum, as well as books on the books of the Bible and things along that nature. And that kind of instilled in me not just a more of a love for the Bible, but also just a love for the subject and the science that is theology. Fast forward, I became heavily involved in the Reformed world. For viewers who do not know what that is essentially the Calvinistic world. Reformed is the label that Calvinism gives itself. Calvinism was a kind of an insulting moniker that was labeled to them, although they embrace it mostly today. A Reformed world, mainly in the world of Reformed, the Reformed Baptist / fundamentalist world. So in fundamentalism, right, this is kind of the hardcore, anti-Catholic stream of what people think of when they think of Protestantism. This is also, and again, depending on where you go, this was just my experience. I found a lot of it to be very ahistorical. And so as an example, very little study into church history and very strong claims that were very anti-Catholic things, kind of common anti-Protestant or anti-Catholic monikers, like the Pope is the Antichrist, the Church is the Whore of Babylon, things along that nature. And it wasn't until the age of 19 where I really, for several years up to the age of 19, had been questioning whether or not I was truly in a right relationship, justified before God, because I looked at my own life, I looked at the life of my soul and saw that there was so much sin and wickedness. And it kind of propelled me on a journey to investigate the scriptures more to see if I could figure out how to truly be justified in God's sight. And long story short, kind of took 4 years, but I came kicking and screaming into the Catholic faith because I was very anti-Catholic. So it took a lot of reading of church history to kind of bash down and debunk a lot of the positions that I had held up to that point. So yeah, I came into the church in 2020 itself in the midst of that chaotic Easter tide. You know, it was absolutely crazy coming in. And yeah, I haven't looked back at it since. It's been an interesting 5 years, to say the least. I definitely feel like I've grown a lot, learned a lot, met a lot of cool people, seen a lot of craziness in our own church, but also a lot of cool stuff like the conversions of people like Candace Owens and let's hope Tucker Carlson in the future, etc. And so, yeah, that's a short version of my story.
Indeed. Yeah, it's impressive. You name you know, a bunch of converts, or, you know, Candace Owens, and then there's a few others. A lot of them aren't actually, like, the notable people aren't Gen Zers, mm-hmm. though, of course, you can't really have notable people that are from Gen Z that are converting.
Not because
Gen Z is young. It's still such a young generation that you're not going to hear, like, well-established people that are Gen Z that are converting to Catholicism. So of course, you know, so it might give the impression that older people are converting to Catholicism, not necessarily Gen Z. But I think that's just because where the spotlight is usually shined, not necessarily because Gen Z isn't interested. But have you seen sort of, I know you were in like a Bible study group that was part of your conversion. Did you see a lot of like non necessarily like super theologically focused Gen Z people come into the Catholic Church as well? Like people that, you know, you have a strong focus on theology, which is why you're called the traditional Thomist. But somebody mm-hmm. like me, I'm not necessarily the theology man. So have you seen that?
It's a good question. I would say yes and no. It kind of depends on maybe the level. So yes, in the sense that I've seen people who have converted because they not only just see like the truths of the Catholic faith, but then they also recognize that there's something missing in their life, something that's just not right. I mentioned this on Avoiding Babylon yesterday, actually, but the reality is that, you know, when we see the rise of the internet, nowadays we are by osmosis exposed to so much evil, right? We can be here in America and like in a safe neighborhood, etc., but be exposed to so much evil, whether that's, you know, the world of raging politics with, you know, 91 indictments against a former president by another president, to a potential civil war, to potential World War III in Ukraine, to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, all kinds of things. And as opposed to when you and I were young, where, you know, we grew up during the Iraq War and Afghan War, it was all kind of over there. We didn't really think about it because we were growing up, you know, and if we did see anything about it or heard about it, maybe it was like on a TV screen in the background, or maybe mom and dad or our grandparents talked about it or something, but that was about it. But now there's a little bit more flesh and blood, because the oldest person in Gen Z, right? Gen Z begins in 1994, roughly. It kind of depends on like what category you're wanting to look at it. You know, it's going to be around 27, 28 years old, right? And because of that, it's strange to think that there's not even one person in Gen Z that's 30 years old yet, right? And so we're all pretty young, which means a good chunk of us are in the realm of the draft. And so, you know, we're confused and we're like, oh, there's a little bit more flesh on this. So we see all these problems. And so many people say, okay, I'm exposed to so much of this. There has to be some good in this world. Some people, unfortunately, they go down the rabbit hole of sin and vice. We see our generation, 25% is involved in the rainbow movement. We see mass amounts who are addicted to drugs. 11% of America as a total is addicted to prescription drugs, not to mention all of the illegal drugs. You know, our generation suffers from extremely high depression, extremely high anxiety, as well as massively high suicide rates. So people who are not involved in a lot of this, or maybe they are, they're seeing that there's something wrong with this world. and they're not accepting, maybe like the millennial generation did, the new atheism. Some people do, of course, but they're not accepting as much of that. They're wanting to, particularly if they're male, find a sense of identity, find a sense of connection to the past, to a patrimony, to a culture, because they don't want to be living in a world where, on the one hand, they're told, you, because especially if you're male, you know, you're terrible, you're trash, but you have to go fight a war and just suck it up because that's what you're supposed to do. They don't want to live that type of world. They want connection to something ancient, something beautiful. And so because of all this, I think a lot of people are, through the arts, through beauty, through the liturgy, and even through the academic realm, are finding their ways into the Catholic faith. And I think upon arriving, you'll notice that all of the major influencers or converts, for the most part, of today's time period, they're all coming into the Latin Mass or Eastern Rites or the Anglican Ordinariate, right? That's where they're going. They're not really going into your average, quote, parish. They're going into something that is really calling them higher, something that is challenging, you know, the vestiges of a soul that's been racked with liberalism in the United States for decades. And so I see it a fair amount. And I do see a lot of people, even like myself, who do kind of go down the more academic route. But I think the thing that unites all of us, whether it's academic primarily or spirituality or wanting to feel a part of something greater, is the desire to have our hearts filled with something greater. And what that is it's just the Catholic iteration of we're made for God. We're made to know, love, and serve God. And that's what we're all crying out for. So how we get there, there's a lot of ways, but that's the end goal that we're trying to get to.
Yeah, we're also the most sort of brainwashed at this point. Most obviously brainwashed generation. You can see that. You said the 25% of Gen Zers are part of the Rainbow Coalition and that sort of thing, or Rainbow groups. But I mean, that's pure. That's pure abuse or pure brainwashing. Those are like the two options. There's probably maybe like 2% of that maybe that's not caused specifically by either of those things, but that's a substantial amount of those people that have been affected by that. Also, just because society has accepted those types of perversions and actually bring people further, like promote those people. They want to fit in. So as people who want to fit in, they're going to join these things. But it's become so obvious that I can't help but imagine otherwise that the smartest people of our generation will be rejecting it. Now, how they reject it, you're right. It's another question. I think sort of the red pill people, sort of the manosphere, I mean, there's not everybody in that area I think is totally bad, but they're jumping into that because they see society say I hate men, and they now hate society, or they hate women now, you know, sort of two options for that. Do you see the manosphere being just a reaction to this sort of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the manosphere, it was a long time coming in the sense that man or woman, depending on who you are, we all have inside of us an innate dislike for being trashed, and people can only really be pushed so far in whatever issue it be. Right. That's what we talk about, like pendulum swing in politics all the time, is that, you know, people get pushed one way so far and then they kind of go back to the other extreme. And I think you've seen the same thing with the world of gender. Men have in the United States been taken for granted, let's just be honest, for a really long time. And they've also been trashed by an education system for a really long time, whether that be in grade school, starting off with forcing young boys to sit still for 8.5 hours. And if they're not, and they're prescribed as ADD and pumped full of drugs by a pharmaceutical industry that just wants to make more money. Like, that's wrong. And that happens a lot. I have a lot of friends who have gone down that route. And, you know, what's really sad to me is I have these friends who have gone down that route, you know, who were, quote, fidgety in class in second grade and are now being full of drugs, and they recognize the problem of what happened to them, but their bodies are so addicted to these things that they still go and get their prescription, even though they don't need it. They really don't need it anymore. And these guys are outside of college now, you know, I mean, crazy stuff. And then, of course, you see the fact that in colleges, particularly in universities, men are denigrated and hated, particularly, of course, if you're also Caucasian, right? That's an added layer or level of malice that's attached. And because of this, men eventually just say, okay, I am told that I'm essentially trash and that my male desires and my male tendencies are toxic in and of themselves. And so what do, right? Well, there's something very manlike to rebel against that and say, you know what, to heck with this. I'm going to restore, if you will, what my grandparents had, what my great grandparents had, right? A country or a nation or a people that respects men in authority. So there's something very good about that. However, with all pendulum swings, there is extremes. And I think that unfortunately you have seen, particularly in the more well-known manosphere kind of guys, a lot of extremes. As an example, if you take the premise that men are naturally polygamous and you know, compatible with many sexual partners, then you are going to be promoting, therefore, a hedonistic lifestyle, which is not conducive, one, to holiness, but even just on the level of reason, our souls will be eaten alive through promiscuity. That's just the factor. And it's a double standard that demands that women be chaste and, you know, not be involved in, you know, pornography or something to that effect. But then also simultaneously, you can have lots of sexual partners yourself. So it's elements like that that are wrong. It is also elements where treating women as if they are, kind of like Aristotle will talk about, misbegotten men, treating women as if they are something which is truly inferior in the sense of that they don't have the mental capacity or faculties for reason and therefore should be kind of just led around and used. These are abuses and these are wrong. The mean in the middle is the person of Christ. The mean in the middle is Saint Joseph. The mean in the middle is virtue. It is, on the one hand, recognizing you are a man, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But because you are a human, we all have fallen tendencies, both men and women do. And then how do we combat these fallen tendencies? They have to be through time-honored virtue, which, again, maybe sounds simple, but virtue is a lifelong process of acquiring various habits in different parts of you. And I think the more particularly someone practices the Catholic faith, the more they will be shown how much problems they really do have. In every area, whether that comes to chastity, humility, even just the way that they think about other people, not jumping to immediate suspicion of them, etc. And so while I do think, yes, the manosphere has a lot of good points, I do think that in a lot of its popular solutions, it's unfortunately been quite lacking, and it's not going to fulfill men, because money won't fulfill men, pleasure won't fulfill men, only God will fulfill men.
One of the funniest things that I heard from sort of that type, this was sort of, I think this is just pure bad Protestant theology too. This guy's not really like in the Andrew Tate thing, but one of the guys said that hatred comes from women.
Interesting. Okay. That's I'd say it comes from all of us.
Yeah. Isn't that a crazy sort of thing to say?
It is pretty wild. And I'm wondering what he means by it. I wonder if what he means is that like, drama and malice comes from like an angry woman, but the reality is that, you know, no human being is incapable of hatred or anger. I mean, that's just part of one of our appetites, the irascible appetite, you know, that's all.
Yeah, he said angry man is a woman.
Angry man is, oh, well, yeah, maybe what he's trying to say is something to the effect of like, if you're only angry, then you're acting like a woman. And again, I would disagree with that. I will say, you know, the one thing I will say, at least where he can be correct maybe to a degree, is that, you know, the book of Proverbs and Ecclesiasticus both talk about many times the anger of women. And sometimes, I mean, remember, these are inspired by the Holy Ghost. And when scripture says something like, it would be better for you to live on the edge of a house in the attic or in the desert by yourself than with an angry woman, you know, whatever. This is coming from King Solomon, who was married to, I think it was 400 wives and had 2,000 concubines. So it's like, you know, the guy ought to know, you know, that it's probably not a good idea. So there's like a truth, but to be fair, men are not incapable of that on the opposite end.
And I just don't think you don't become a woman.
You don't become a woman. Yeah.
No, it's just goofy. But yeah, so we have sort of society attacking young men, attacking any sort of semblance of traditional morality. And to me, it seems that the Catholic Church, at least even if the hierarchy isn't always upholding this, written down, there is a solidified belief system of morality within the Catholic Church. Do you think that's a big part of Gen Z looking for that or finding that and saying, I want to be Catholic?
Yeah, 1,000%. I think that when you look at a lot of people in Gen Z are raised several generations down from the sexual revolution, which I call sexual anarchy, because that's all that it is, right? A revolution implies in the term that it's bringing about, you know, these objectively good rights, if you will, to the common man. Whereas in reality, all that that movement did was allow sex to be used in an anarchy style. And because of that, Gen Z, since it's several generations down from that, has been absolutely wrecked. Just to give one statistic, in the 1960s, there were roughly around 75 to 80% of American houses, right, homes in the United States, who had a married mother and a father and children, right? The ideal nuclear family coming out of the 50s, right? In 1960. Today, that number has been reduced down to 43% of houses in the United States. So it's not even the majority of Americans are married and have kids, right? The vast majority now don't. And what we've seen is that we've separated in the sexual revolution, we've separated sex from procreation and from bonding with one person for the rights of that child, etc. And because of that, people are now living highly promiscuous lives. And because of that, they're having lots of psychological problems, lots of emotional problems, and they're passing a lot of this baggage down to their children through bad advice, right? So through the common moniker that you hear, you got to sleep around a few times to figure out like what you like, or, you know, before marriage, you know, got to try her out before you get married to see if you like her. Horrible advice like that. That's just from literally the pit of hell. And this has a psychological effect. So when it finally gets down to us, right, to Gen Z, we've grown up in a realm where in a world in which we've never known a time without the internet. So unfortunately, we are the generation that was exposed to pornography the quickest. And we've also encountered all of this baggage, if you will, in the physical realm since the 1960s. So as a result of this, so many of us are looking for, and I say so many of us, but I want to point out, particularly young men, are looking for something sane because they see that the world is insane, from everything to war to sex. I mean, just everything. And so because of that, when they look at the Catholic Church, what do they see? A 2,000-year-old institution that claims for itself, we have taught the same thing, and look at all of the results that it has spawned. The creation of Christendom, Western Europe thriving, right? The colonization and the Christianization of the New World, both North and South America, right? The preaching of the gospel in Japan and India, etc., in Africa. And look at all of the saints, look at all of the martyrs. It calls you to something greater, right? It says, yes, this world is messed up. And yes, you have problems, but you don't have to stay there, right? You don't have to just hook yourself to pornography and to drugs and you'll be okay. You can become a saint. And it is this that challenges so many of us. Now, I think the hard thing is that while there's a lot of young guys coming into the faith, a lot of young people coming into the faith, they have a lot of questions, not just about the faith, but also about what the heck is going on in the church, because you can't get around it, right? As long as you have access to the internet or in a parish, you're probably asking what is going on. And unfortunately, I think what you've seen is that on the one side, we have, particularly here online, a civil war, right, of what people could just broadly call, right, a kind of a traditionalist bloc and coalition and a non-traditionalist bloc and coalition. kind of battling it out, right? Both of them who, you know, are very much so orthodox in most of their points of faith, right? But have criticism of each other. Meanwhile, a third camp, the liberals, the leftists who aren't Catholic at all, but occupy great seats of power, are actively obscuring, to put it at least in the most mild way I can, actively obscuring or veiling or trying to change Catholic faith and morals from all issues such as homosexuality to transgenderism, abortion, etc. And because of this, unfortunately, you see, and I know you've seen it, a lot of guys leave the faith and go where? To Eastern Orthodoxy, which also calls men to be great and calls men to be holy. But at the same time, right, you don't have, if you will, the political baggage. It's an easy solution to a much more complicated problem. And so, yeah, I do think a lot of us are coming in. But the question I think will be interesting is how many of us will actually plant roots here and stay?
Isn't that political baggage, you know, just as prevalent in the East, in the Orthodox
community? I'd say to a degree, it kind of depends on the angle you want to take. So, and what I mean by that is that our system as Catholics is very top heavy, right? So we have correctly, as a reaction to the secularization of Christendom from the Protestant rebellion till in the Enlightenment, the liberal revolutions, and et cetera, up until now, we've been forced to place a lot of emphasis on the office of the papacy. And when you dig down into Catholic ecclesiology, it makes sense because, you know, all denominations that, if you will, are conservative in their thought, all agree that God has given divine revelation to man, right? Maybe they will place the authority of that divine revelation in different categories. As Catholics, of course, we believe in scripture and tradition, make up the whole deposit of faith, right? For instance, Anglicans, they will hold to a form of Protestant thought called prima scriptura, where basically the Bible is the primary source of authority, but then they also fall back onto tradition as a very heavy authority and even reason. Lutheranism in the Reformed world, when they say sola scriptura, they don't mean, unfortunately, I think, what a lot of Catholics believe, where it's just the Bible and that is it. What sola scriptura means is that the Bible is the only infallible source of truth, not that it is the only source of truth. And so they'll say the Bible is the thing which is at the top, but then, yeah, like tradition and reason, all of that, that can come into effect, but it's just not on the same level as the Bible, etc. Catholics or Orthodox, they practice something very similar to us. What we have to hold, though, is the papacy, which is that Christ instituted an actual teaching magisterium and teaching arm that will teach all people for all time until the end of the world. And so because of that, we focus so much more on the top. The East focuses way more locally, more at each other. And this is, I think, where maybe while on the one hand, they do have physical political problems in the sense of, particularly with the war right now, Russia and Ukraine's Orthodox churches excommunicating one another. And then even before that in 2014, right, the Ecumenical Patriarch and the Russian Patriarch excommunicating one another and having a schism, right? They have that political thing. In their theology, though, I would say they are also very compromised, particularly in areas of morals. So most of what we struggle with right now in the Catholic world is debates on morals, not so much dogmatic stuff, but moral theology. Things along the nature of, you know, like, is it always objectively wrong for X, Y, and Z thing to take place? And in the Orthodox world, it is very much so free pickings in many way, depending on the priest, depending on the rite. So as an example, the topic of contraception, right? It really does come down to the particular rite that you're in and the particular priest in that rite, whether he's going to say contraception is okay. And maybe he'll say, you know, maybe one will say no in all circumstances. Maybe one will say it's only permissible in like this particular circumstance, maybe with like a medicinal reason attached. And then there'll be others that will just be like, well, you know, if you're just trying to be safe, then engage in contraceptive use, etc. The issue of divorce and remarriage, right? There's up to like 30 different reasons now that the Orthodox will give as permissible reasons for a divorce and remarriage. And then there's other rites that give way less. So there is all of these weird tendencies, not just to mention the fact that whenever you look at a lot of their theology now, a lot of their most popular writers are universalists in their salvation. Also, when it comes to other important aspects of faith, so like, if you will, broader penal substitutionary atonement, not so much the Protestant version, but like the broader sense of Christ being a substitute. You know, you see this clearly in the writings of the church fathers, but yet the Orthodox deny these things. And so all kinds of issues. And so I think, unfortunately, a lot of Catholics who aren't catechized properly, and also I would say maybe they're just not exposed to good material that kind of walks people through the crisis and things along that nature. They see the beautiful liturgy. They see basically the same claims that we got for becoming Catholic, and then they jump to ship to the Orthodox realm.
Yeah, because we're also over, like, especially in the trad communities or trad discussions and stuff like that, we're crying out for better liturgies. We're trying to do that, so then if somebody, you know, stops the fight, doesn't want to continue the fight, and just wants to run off to find good liturgy, they can find that more likely at Eastern Orthodox. Though, couldn't they just do that in Eastern Catholic Church? I mean, so many of the people who don't want to become associated with trads but do want good liturgy go to the Eastern Catholic churches.
Yeah, I think a lot do. I don't know how I guess it would depend. My question to them would be, what would be your main reason for leaving? So if it is literally just a liturgical preference, then perhaps, yeah, that could work. I think, though, that for a lot of people, and I don't think it's a trad thing anymore. I think it's a mainstream conservative thing where, I mean, because I talk to people all the time who don't go to the Latin Mass who are like, what is going on? You know, I think it's just, I think it's become very mainstream, particularly in the United States. And for a lot of them, you know, it's not a liturgical preference. It's, what is Pope Francis saying? What is Pope Francis doing? And for them, I think he becomes the reason that people want to leave. I mean, as an example, anybody who's done any type of serious Catholic evangelization, particularly into Protestants, right? What is the one great stumbling block that you always get? It's not the papacy in and of itself so much anymore. It's, but that guy, Pope Francis. It's, he's become the hardest thing for evangelization. Even my own parents, right? They've come around a lot to the Catholic faith, but he's one of the big stumbling blocks. And it's somewhat, at least, understandable because, you know, you see the Catholic claims about the papacy, and then you see sometimes the things that he says and does, and you shake your head. And so I think a lot of people, just depends on what it is for, as well as, I would say, particularly a lot of young people, I think it kind of falls into this step, right? They see the problems with the young world, with the world. They become interested in Catholicism. They find maybe a few good podcasts, right? They start watching a few good podcasts, maybe read a few good books. They become confirmed to the faith, etc. But then they don't take root. And I think a lot of times you'll see a lot of trads, they'll become very embittered against the system. And I think that goes back to people focusing so much on the crisis as opposed to like the normative Catholic life, which is to become a saint, like practice the interior life, etc. The normative Catholic life, which is, you know, to study a traditional catechism and to do your rosary and to, you know, by God's grace, strive to clean up your life. They're not focusing in on that. And so they go off into the bitter realm. And then you have other people who, you know, maybe it is just a liturgical thing for them. And unfortunately, I think they do boil down the crisis to just a liturgical preference, as opposed to like what I've done in my research on my show, getting into the missals themselves, looking at the general instruction themselves, going back and reading all of the authors of the Concilium team, etc. Like getting into that type of nitty gritty. They would rather not do that. So yeah, that's kind of my thought, at least on that, is that it kind of just depends on the person.
Do you think the focus on the crisis is detrimental in the way that it also pulls people away from sort of sanctifying society? Like, because, as you know, we have the priests and then we have the bishops, we have the clergy who are supposed to be sanctifying sort of the hierarchy, you know, sanctifying the hierarchy. And then we have the laity who are supposed to sanctify the secular world, you know, exactly. Sort of thing. But a way to get around that, or to feel like you're getting around that, is to be focused on the job that you're not responsible for. So do you think that's a big problem with the crisis, is that it's distracting people from their proper societal mission?
Yeah, I would say 1000%. And I think it kind of depends on the avenue or the mode of information that the person's receiving. What I mean by that is that you'll find, I think, particularly people who read books on the crisis, I find are generally way healthier than people who just watch podcasts on the crisis. You know, and I think the reason
emotion.
Because it's like the, you know, with a book, you're able just to kind of sit down. It's your voice, if you will, playing in your head. And you're just kind of going along, you're reading about it, you're reflecting on it, you're thinking about it. And it's way more of just reading is a much more healthy activity long-term, of course. Whereas, and you know, it's systematic, it's laid out for you. Whereas with most podcasting, and I, you know, I say this as a podcaster, it's so much of it's just news. What has the Pope done today? What has the Pope done today? What is he going to do in 5 days from now? You know, we're all kind of waiting, like what's going to happen? And if you go through, like I have now, 5 years of that, it wears you down. It wears you down. And so, therefore, it distracts you from sanctifying yourself by God's grace, right? So, like as an example, if you were to ask the average traditionalist who's spending so much time watching podcasts and worrying about what the Pope does, if you ask him, okay, you know this stuff, but can you name for me the Ten Commandments? Can you name for me the six laws of the church? Can you name for me the fruits or at the gifts of the Holy Ghost? Can you explain to me, you know, the step-by-step process of how you should overcome the purgative way, right? Do you even know what the purgative way is? Stuff like that. You know, if they can't, then it goes to show you, I think, a fundamental, I would say, displacement of what's important for the Catholic life. And because of that, since they're not sanctifying their life and they're spending so much time falling into that, I think that they're more disposed to give themselves over to actual sins. So as an example, having suspicion of everybody. So as an example, just having a suspicion for a bishop just because he's a bishop, right? Or having suspicion for a priest just because he's a priest, right? And I think that that's detrimental. And the fruit of that is that, you know, traditionalists, it depends on where you go, but like we should just look like, well, nice dressed, normal people, right, who are striving for sanctity, and we should be the most joyful people because we should be focusing in on the person of Christ, the person of Our Lady, on the Catholic faith and growing. And when you do read those people, you know what I'm talking about, like they're very good people, very well-rounded. When you read those communities, they're just full of love and joy. But then there's those other communities where you walk in and you're like, okay, that lady is wearing like 50 different scapulars. She has like 30 different devotions she's doing. And she's so incredibly scrupulous. And then when you say hi to her, like the first thing she's talking about is basically this elaborate plot that she heard on some type of show about how the world is going to be like taken over by frogmen. Like just crazy, wild stuff where you're just like, okay, cool. Can you quote John 3:16 to me? You know, stuff like where you're just, it wears you down. It makes you sad. And so my point, I think, is that unless we as a movement get refocused on what is important, right? Which is saving our soul. The whole point of all of scripture is to save one soul and finding that in the person of Christ. Unless we do that, unless we're filled with his joy, with his love, we're not going to be able to go out and to see other people as objects of God's love. You know, the trad should go down the street and not think, I'm better than these other, you know, Novus Ordo Catholics. He shouldn't think, oh, I'm so much better than all of these normie people out in the world. Because what is that? That's the Pharisee in Luke 18 saying, God, I'm glad that I am not like other men, that you've not made me like other men. Rather, we should be like the tax collector and say, be merciful to me, a sinner. And then when we encounter people, we bring them through love and through joy and through teaching, right? And through the example of our own lives to the goodness of what the Catholic faith offers.
Indeed. Very well put. Now, we talked a little bit about sort of the political converts and sort of the, I guess, influencer converts, I guess you could say. Now, there can be sort of another problem where people are just joining Catholicism because of the political element of it.
Yes.
You know, it's countercultural. It's, you know, sort of, it's being attacked, so therefore people join it or something like that, or at least seem like they're going to join it. you know, and I think we need to be cautious about that. And people who are like listening to or focused on Catholicism because of the politics really need to, you know, dive into the faith, as you said, the things that people don't know, just as if you're focused on the crisis. But if you're too focused on politics, that's also a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the issue is, unfortunately, a lot of young men, it's again, kind of the tendencies that you do see in the modern world with going to extremes. And I would say it's a result because of the internet, largely. They see the problems with secular democracy, rightly so. But what they go to that is all of a sudden full-blown national socialism, and Adolf is now a saint, and just the most base thing ever. And you know what's and you know what I'm talking about, like average Catholic out there, you know, those Catholic Instagram accounts where they're somehow trying to blend like the Catholic faith with a national socialist platform. I've talked about it on my show that I've seen a disturbing trend of young men who, right, they see the problem with secular democracy. No complaints there, right? I fully agree. Yeah. That is a problem, 100%. But then their solution is, whether they realize it or not, a secular authoritarian state, because Nazism is incompatible with the Catholic faith. You have over 400 canonized martyrs from that period that the church has canonized. You read their stories of the Catholic martyrs, and it's beautiful stories of Catholic priests who were thrown into concentration camps, and they would give every bit of food to people in the concentration camps. And people would convert. They'd be like, wow, I thought Christians were terrible people, but I actually see Christ in you. Like, I mean, beautiful stories where Catholic nuns and Catholic priests and lay people were giving their lives for people. And somehow, yeah, these guys today, you know, they're 16, they have an Instagram account or a webcam, and they think that all of a sudden they know everything. And they think somehow, yeah, you can bring the two ideologies together. And if people are interested, I have a video on my show called Catholicism versus Nazism. And I go through the 25 to 28 Nazi Party platform points from the original, you know, 1930s Nazi platform. And I show how it's incompatible with Christianity. Just to give one example, their idea, they started their own denomination, first off, so it's not really a Catholic thing. They first started their own denomination. It's called Positive Christianity. And essentially, it is an ideology which teaches that Christ, that the Old Testament was evil, right? It was all corrupt. It was all just a bunch of Jewish myths. And that Christ came on earth, and he was a Nordic figure. And his job on earth was to fight the satanic Jews. Oh, yes, that sounds very much so like what the New Testament message says, right? Especially when St. Paul says that, you know, there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male or female. We're all one in Christ. Or, you know, when Christ says, love one another as I have loved you, right? The world will know you're my disciples based off of your love. That should be a good litmus test for every single Catholic influencer, particularly young men. If I go to your account, will I truly find the world will know you are my disciple based off the way that you love other people? I don't think that that's the case.
Yeah. Well, also, these people have just such a poor understanding of history.
100%.
Like, absolutely no understanding of anything. And the, like, if you're at odds with St. Maximilian Kolbe, I think yeah. There's a problem with you and not St. Maximilian Kolbe.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just that the narcissism the idea that you think you're better or you know better in that area is insane. Now, I think the thing that I'm hoping to fill that kind of craze, you know, like to think you're going to go straight to National Socialism is ridiculous. You know, I'm doing a series about counter revolutions,
mm-hmm.
sort of, and, you know, people like the Papal Zouaves, the Vandeans, the Carlists, mm-hmm. Just martyrs for the faith in Roman times, these types of things. Like, I'm hoping that these examples of fighting back against sort of the society, or the pagan, the liberal, you know, communism, you know, all these different things. I hope it shows people that there is an element of Catholicism that is fighting back against this, but you don't go for the insane people that also hate the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. There's so many good examples of Catholics who have risen up and they've seen the problems with history. And what I find truly sad, and you hinted at this, is that these gentlemen, unfortunately, I think, know very little about human history or just about philosophy. So as just one example, you know, Aquinas, he lays out in his various political treatises the three types of government that he finds to be acceptable, and then the three types of government he finds to be not acceptable. And the three types of acceptable government, he says, are a monarchy, an aristocracy, and a republic. And then the three, you know, if you will, distasteful forms of government, oligarchy, you know, anarchy, but then also going all the way down to just what you would just call like a pure democracy, if you will. The pure democracy of the Greeks, as is the good example with the Athens democracy. And as a result of this, Aquinas, though, he gives the pros and cons, if you will, to all the good systems. And he finishes by saying, he hints about this in his treatise on law. I find it actually very funny. He says, all of these systems essentially will work. However, the key is that the person or persons have to be virtuous. They have to be holy. They have to be good men. And he gives the example, for instance, with a republic. He says, if, for instance, the people who are electing these representatives become impure and unvirtuous and harmful to the good common, like the common good of the civilization, then their rights, if you will, should be stripped from them. And their job, if you will, of ruling the people should be given to a few good and honorable and virtuous men. Right? He's quoting from Augustine's, one of his political treatises. And so regardless of your system, you have to be holy. And so, yes, you want to escape the bad crumbling system that's right now. Great. But why would you want to embrace an equally disgusting system? Well, I would say even more so, because, you know, at least with us, we're not rounding people up, but you know, another disgusting system, etc. You know, it doesn't work.
Well, also, I mean, at the point of a republic, it's really hard to have all these different holy people. Like, how, like, what's harder, having the society of voting people be holy, or one person?
I know, and that's the rough thing, because it reminds me of that famous quote from The Patriot, right, with Mel Gibson, where they're debating on whether they should be levied, the state of South Carolina should levy money for the Continental Army, and he says, why, Mr. Hammond, right, should I worry about one tyrant 3,000 miles away when I can have 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away? And the problem is both are true. Like, if the good thing is, it's like with the republic, if you have a bunch of bad people, right, you can just vote them out in an ideal world, right? But that, again, presumes that the population is virtuous. On the other end, with monarchy, like, yeah, if you have a King David up there, a Blessed Carl up there, right, it's going great. But if you have a Nero up there, it's going horrible. And so as I've kind of gone back and forth in my own thought in the last 5 years of being Catholic, because being Catholic challenges you to look outside of the kind of normie American political system. Like, I don't know which one is the better system. That's the thing. Like, I can see pros and cons to all of them. And I think, again, no matter what the situation is, I think just virtue is the key.
Well, what's the easiest thing to change, though? Like, if you're looking at the three systems, sort of aristocracy, and republicanism, which I've heard it also just be called polity.
Yeah.
That which I think republicanism kind of makes us think of something else, which republicanism basically has always been anti-Catholic.
In some form, yeah. It's always been somewhat, yeah.
Starting with the French Revolution, I would say they were the ones who called themselves Republicans in just Republicans. I mean, there was an element in America like that, but it what people really think of Republican is really, and sort of worldwide level, is really the French Revolution, not really American as American. But then I mean, if you, so an aristocracy versus a monarchy, what's going to change quickest? Well, you know, the monarchy or the one leader, mm-hmm. if he dies or if he has a conversion, you know, that's so much quicker of a change than having to like convert a whole population with a republic or convert a small group of people in an aristocracy. I mean, that's more likely than converting a polity. But so I just, that seems hard for me to like pursue a polity or an aristocracy.
Yeah. And I think this is why St. Robert Bellarmine talks about, he talks about this in the context of the papacy in his book on the Roman Pontiff, but that in a certain ideal world, like a mixture of all three forms of government would be ideal. Because on the one hand, you know, I think we can ask the question, like, what would be quickest? But, you know, think about this. Let's just say, for sake of story, we have all of a sudden, right, just out of nowhere, a Catholic monarch shows up in the United States. Okay, how many Americans are going to put up with that? And how many of the U.S. Army is going to put up with that? Like the U.S. military, you know? Like, so what we're now saying is that, okay, even if you have a Catholic monarch, that still presumes that there is some level of good society under him, or else basically he's just a guy with a crown. You know, it doesn't really matter. Same thing as I think with a republic is that, you know, you have to have good people put good people into power. And so this is where I think, like, maybe the question should be, what is the quickest, but what is the most effective? And I think the most effective thing is that regardless of the system, whether it's a mix or a pure system in one of those, that we have to build a culture in which is truly virtuous. And that could be something that maybe we never see, but we lay the roots for. It's something that, for instance, Steve Cunningham has talked a little bit about on Census Fidelium, where he's, as an example, he's an open secessionist for the state of South Carolina, right? Right. Yeah. So I'm not blackmailing or anything. He's open on his show about it. But like one of the good points that I do appreciate that he makes is that the task of trying to get 50 states all to become virtuous is a massive undertaking. I mean, 365 million Americans, that's a lot of work. You know, and all the institutions involved, from education to the military to banks to just hospitals, everything, you know. And so maybe, I don't know, you know, I pray that America continues to go on and to become better. Howdy, sir. But I do think, you know, there is a fair chance that the United States eventually one day will break up, kind of like the USSR did. And as an example, like here in the great state of Texas where I'm at, if we were to become like a Catholic republic or a Catholic monarchy, I wouldn't bat an eye about that. And I think it'd be way easier than trying to get, you know, everything together. And who knows, maybe the old CSA or something reunites at that moment, but then they embrace Catholicism like their one and only president did at the end of his life. So you never know.
Yeah, I have come to the conclusion that America is too big indeed. And I don't really know where that leads me necessarily, but that is kind of a recognition that it's too much. Just as the European Union is way too big. And also, it's way too big to be run by democracy, I guess. That's the main thing. I guess you could see sort of an emperor or a king ruling over such a big thing. But as you said, to build a society that would be worthy of a good Catholic king or something like that, you know, that would be, that's very difficult. So that's very unlikely to happen. But yeah, you make a good point that, you know, you could see a Texas, a Catholic Texas before you'd see a Catholic America.
Yeah. I think the thing is, it's like, and I don't mean to like throw cold water on all my fellow monarchists out there, but it's like, I think it's way more likely that if the U.S. does break up, you'll see warlordism before you'll see monarchy. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a much higher chance that there's going to be bands of men who just gather weapons together and basically in some maybe like post-apocalyptic sense, rule over a city or over a section of land or something, then you'll see like, you know, a 13th century monarch descend down from the sky, but yet he has the United States flag behind him, and, you know, and he consecrates America to the Sacred Heart. Like, that'd be epic, but that's just probably not going to happen. It'd be epic.
Warlords or dictators or whatever don't last. Like, they have to be replaced by something.
Exactly. But see, that's the thing. And so that's where it's interesting. But like, for instance, I don't know how much study you've done when it comes to the Afghanistan conflict, but this actually is a good example of what we're talking about. When Afghanistan fought against the Soviet Union back in the 70s, et cetera, right? It was a bunch of warlords who basically put down their differences and formed the Mujahideen, right? The Holy Warriors of Islam. And they went and fought against the Soviets. And truth be told, just on a military level, right? I'm not obviously endorsing any of their ideology, but on a military level, it was quite impressive the fact that they managed to beat them off. Like, that's why Afghanistan is known as the nation that armies go to die. And, you know, they beat them off. But then after that, you saw the whole country falls apart into warlordism for quite a while, so much so that it was said that you need like 5 passports to go to Afghanistan because there was all different like sections breaking off and fighting. And Mullah Omar, who was the founder of the Taliban, the reason he became as popular as he was is, one, he was a veteran from that Afghan-Soviet war. He had lost an eye in a firefight in a mosque with the Soviets. But he also managed to, after that point, he was really well known as like a good religious leader. But he wasn't very charismatic figure at first. He was very quiet. He was an introvert. And this warlord went and kidnapped several young girls from his local village. And the people basically said, "Mullah Omar, help us." And so I wish that we had like priests like this a little bit, not maybe to this excessive degree that I'm about to describe, but just a little bit with more fire in their belly. So what he does is, the mullah, is he gets a bunch of AKs and he gets a tank, and they ram down the wall of this guy's compound, this warlord's compound. That, you know, they kill the warlord and they like hang his body up. But then after that, you know, he has this quote vision from Muhammad, and Muhammad tells him that he's supposed to rule over an Islamic Afghanistan. He's supposed to be the leader of the faithful. And then the Taliban movement is formed. He grows from like 30 men to 10,000 within a week. Like, it's crazy. My whole point with this, though, is that he was able then to put down a lot of the warlords and unite a lot of the country, etc. We know the rest of the story. If you did in the United States see a breakup, right, you would have to find some type of charismatic person to rise up. But whereas Islam is like the roots so heavily rooted in Afghanistan, what is the so heavily rooted thing in the United States? It's like, it's not Islam, obviously, but it's not, I wouldn't even say Catholicism. Like, if anything, it might be evangelicalism to a degree, but I would say even underneath that layer of evangelicalism, it's, and I don't think that this is all bad, and this is actually where a lot of trans get mad at me, but it's a, to a degree, a little bit of the spirit of 1776, of leave us alone, let us rule ourselves and do our life, right? There's a good and a bad version of that. And so, unfortunately, I think that would be more likely to take place than a, unfortunately, Catholic monarch.
I just don't think, I think 76 is dead. I think it's been killed.
I don't think it's dead. I think, well, I guess it's two things. One, I don't think it's dead because it's so rooted, I would say, in a certain sense, in fallen man. Goes back to like, don't push me, you know, it's like the whole point of the don't tread on me flag. There's a certain point there where people go before they just like lose it. You know what I'm saying? And unfortunately, I think we've been so inundated for a while that point has been pushed a little bit further. But I would say that there are those certain values that are in that, not all, I'm not endorsing all of them, but like certain values that are in that, that I do think we as young people need to preserve. I do think we've taken a lot for granted in the United States.
Is this going to happen?
Bro, is it going to happen? That'd be interesting. That could be interesting. But probably not. I do think that there are certain things for our generation. Like, we have to, one, recognize, like, we've taken a lot of the liberties in the United States for granted. We've taken a lot of our freedoms for granted. Most of us have never been asked to go and fight in any type of foreign war. Because we've not been asked to fight for anything, we take it for granted. While I'm not endorsing everything in the United States system, I do think that the United States system, or at least certain ideas behind it, right, in 1776, I think are worth contemplating and fighting for. Now, what those are, I think that's open for more, you know, broader discussion, but I think they're at least worth it. I don't think they're completely dead.
I mean, it's the most, it is the most reasonable revolutionary government. I'll give it that.
I would also say most successful. Like, it is kind of surprising the fact, like, you see France, like, they go insane, and then they, like, implode pretty much, like, 5 minutes after, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just crazy.
Well, it is based on English liberties. Like, that, exactly, that's yeah. the difference. France didn't have, like, that type of didn't have English liberty, mm-hmm. common law. So they just have no, they were basically looking at English and were like, let's force everyone into what we think they have.
Mm-hmm.
And the crazy thing is, like, the English were like, oh, this is terrible. What are you guys doing?
Mm-hmm. It's so funny, like, reading Burke, his criticisms of the French Revolution. I agree with them, but it's just, it's funny because, like, France, you know, like, we all know it as, like, the nation of, like, love and stuff. That's just kind of, like, what the media portrays it as. But then when it gets to politics, bro, they go harder than I think any other European country. Like, we think of Italians as, like, the firebrands and stuff like that. But let's just be honest, the French, like, in everything they write, it's like tooth and nail. I mean, you read theology, like, you read a theologian from England, he's contemplating, he's thinking about stuff. Read one from France, and it's just like, you know, everybody's a heretic. I'm going after your throat. You know, it's very funny.
Yes, and now they've imported sort of religious conflict and ethnic conflict in France. So you know, the French wars of religion, like, mm-hmm. That is the most chaotic of all the wars of religion. So I can only imagine what the sort of the next version of that's going to look like. And it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah, I agree. It could be rough. And you bring a good point because, you know, you do see mass migration of Islam into Western countries. And so you might see a reversed, if you will, crusade in our lands.
But Nick, I was told that was a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, everything's a conspiracy theory. I told people this the other day on the Meaning of Catholic, that the kind of moniker of Islam being a religion of peace, I always ask people, like, do you know where that came from? And when they ask you, you let them know, like, yeah, it actually pretty much originates in its common sense with George Bush. Like, that's where it comes from. World-renowned Quranic scholar and Hadith master George Bush.
Well, also the, you know, a big bomber of Islam.
Yeah, exactly. Bomb Saddam. That's George Bush.
It's like, so the logic of that is hilarious because, like, we are going to bomb the religion of peace.
I know. It's just, there's nothing, if you want to just see, like, peak politician, I guess, if you will, at its absolute finest, just look at, like, particularly George Bush Sr. through, like, I would say Barack Obama picked up with Biden time period in the United States. It's just like all presidents have had their issues, right? I personally, like the presidents that I look up to, I think George Washington is very prophetic in so many ways. Like, just as an example, many people obviously know about, like, his famous statement in his farewell address about not being, you know, divided into two different opposing camps and warring against each other in the United States. But he also talks about foreign policy in his final speech. And one of the things he talks about in foreign policy is, he says, don't get bogged down in foreign treaties to such a degree that you can be dragged into wars. And you're just sitting there thinking, wow, this is funny. you know, this is funny. But then, you know, like, you look at, like, Calvin Coolidge as an example. I think he was a phenomenal president. He really did see the Declaration of Independence as not just kind of a statement in U.S. history, but also as, you know, influential, like, as an influential, as a philosophical document up there, right, with the Constitution. He tried to shrink the size of government in a good sense of the term, but also have good morals in that smaller government, you know. But then you see the guys today, and it's just, oh man, you're like, how the heck did you get into power?
Well, the decline of revolution into psychosis, basically, is what I see. But I don't think there's as much of a, like, I don't know. I don't think there's as much of a dislike for non-American style government in America anymore, at least amongst Gen Z. There's been polls that have showed sort of the popularity of monarchy or, like, military dictatorship or stuff like that is growing greatly amongst Gen Z. And of course, it's because we've been told pretty much our entire life that there is no, or we don't have any specific morals or duties or anything that we must do. And now we're looking for somebody, and it's, you know, it's obviously there, people are thinking strong man of some kind, you know, yeah. There's sort of a, you know, there's a lesser version of that that is a good one, you know, that can be a good one. But they're looking for that, and there's no, and that's why influencer is become a thing. Like, that's straight up why, because nobody is getting told what to do in their life from their parents, from their schools. I mean, they are told to be, you know, to be gay, you know, that's basically it, but that's about it. You know, I don't think that really tells you anything about like how to live a life. Even if you were like, you know, pro rainbow, you know, it still doesn't really tell you anything about life outside of sex.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do think that there is a fair chance that you will see some type of military dictatorship in the United States, but I think that will be followed by an immediate civil war of some form, or preceded by, I don't know. But I think it is somewhat likely, just because when you do look again, as you mentioned, at studies, two studies that came to mind is, number one, 84% of American Gen Zers want to be an influencer of some kind. 84%. It's insane. And you know, it's funny. Bad. And it's funny because it's like, I enjoy, like, you know, podcasting and stuff, but like what I actually want to do as a career is to teach in like an academic setting, and then as well as pursue some of my kind of hobbies of, I like to make maybe some movies in the future and write some books in the future.
Yeah, like, that's what I'm right.
Like, yeah, I don't want to I don't want to be an influencer, if you will, in that kind of modern capacity. So 84% want that, but then only less than 25% of American youth, I think it was 22 if memory serves, agree with the statement, I'm proud to be an American. Like, that's the historic low. Whereas you look at the baby boomer generation, it's much, much, much higher. And so what does this tell you? I think it does say that, but the one exception, I will say, the one exception in that latter statistic is in young men. That's the thing. So it's like, young men are becoming more patriotic than young women. They're becoming more conservative than young women. The question is, though, how far do they go, right? Are they going to go to a kind of a fake conservatism of, you know, classical liberalism? Or are they going to go off to nutso land, like we've talked about earlier, with national socialism? You know, like, what, you know, what is it going to be? And unfortunately, I pray that they don't go that far. And so I do think it's fair. I do think it's likely, but I do think that if it is to happen, we'll be much, much older, just because, think about it, like Gen X, they're reaching almost their 50s. Mm-hmm. And they're not in politics for the most part, in the sense of like having the throes of power. Like, think of the big names, like Ron DeSantis, Governor DeSantis. He's one, right? He's, I think he's like 45 or something like that, right? So he's like smack dab in, on like the, you know, kind of middle, if you will, of Gen X. Who's has all the power? It's still all the baby boomers. And it's like, you know, as much as I like
or older than boomers.
Or older. Like, when I look at, as an example, you know, I talk about this on Avoiding Babylon all the time and I get harassed for it, but, you know, I like a lot of Donald Trump's policies and I've been a supporter for years, although I'm not, you know, God Emperor Trump mode or anything like that. I'm a little bit more realistic. But, like, both him and Biden were born in an era where they still had black and white TVs. And we're in a world with iPhones. You know, so there's, and it's not to be an ageist or to say that old people can't contribute or they shouldn't contribute. They should. But I do think that the reality goes to show is that we have like this top end heavy monopoly system of politicians that are controlled by large scale interest groups and businesses. And therefore, they're just money making machines and influential power machines. And so I do think if we do rise to the top, it's going to be much, much later. But I'm hoping that, like, when you and I are 50, as an example, that we don't have like the one Gen Z guy who's like, yeah, Uncle Adolf, so amazing, become like dictator of the United States. Because then at that point, I'm like, yeah, well, maybe I'll uh, maybe I'll leave, you know, maybe it's a good time to say sayonara.
Well, yeah, I think it's like young people go from Uncle Joe is great, meaning Stalin, to now Uncle Adolf, which is like, it's bizarre. They really, like, again, if anybody thinks this way, that Uncle Adolf is their friend, they need to look at all the people that, like, all the right wingers. If you're if you think you're a real, really right wing, look at all the right wingers that he took out.
Yeah,
you know, in order to get power, or you know, with whether it be the Anschluss and the assassination of Engelbert Dollfuss, or you know, the fact that Mussolini more or less despised Hitler going into or in the 30s, and only joined him for, you know, sort of convenience, I guess. You know, these types of things. You know, it's not even amongst actually the people that liked him the most before the war were like left wingers and conservatives, sort of the middle, the center people, the classical liberals that we that are supposed to be the ones that we're told to look up to. Like Churchill was impressed by Hitler, and many of these politicians who caved to Hitler were doing it mostly because they had hope that he wasn't as bad as he or as people thought he would or something like that. They were impressed by his charism or charismaticness. So anyways, it's just kind of strange that people are you know, moving towards his camp. But I think that's just out of spite, basically. I think that's 100%. More likely. I don't think people are going to stay in those camps. I think it will be spite for a little bit, and then hopefully they'll read something and they'll learn something. And once they learn something, hopefully they keep the spite, at least. If the spite keeps them from liberalism or classical liberalism, then the spite was worth it. But yeah. If the spite keeps them from anything reasonable, then it will be the main problem.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point about like that they'll probably give it up because, you know, it's, I feel like for our generation going off, like for right wing people going off and being like, yeah, who needs Uncle Sam? I'll take Uncle Adolf. You know, I think that they would rather do that. And it's probably guys who, again, are very alienated from society, probably don't have girlfriends, probably have a rough home life of some kind, and therefore they kind of go off into these extremes, and rightly, again, they see the problems with society, but they have bad solutions. And so I think that finding, again, that mean is so important for our generation, because I do think our generation will be one of those, because of the internet especially, where we're pulled to all kinds of extremes, where maybe another generation, maybe Gen Alpha or when Gen Beta shows up, which, man, they're going to get picked on a lot, just be called. They're gonna get picked on a lot, but you know, I'm wondering if, for instance,
wait, but won't those be mostly like our kids?
Exactly, yeah. But
we're gonna pick on our own kids, but you know what I mean? Like, beta, yeah, is more of an insult, according to like,
I feel like Gen Z will pick on Gen Beta, like, because we just will,
pick on our own kids.
Probably to a degree, that's kind of sad, but yeah, it's true. I think though that what will be interesting actually though to see is if other generations in the future, if they will, for instance, put like rational regulations on the internet. What I mean by rational is not things like, hey, let me just, you know, like ban your speech into eternity, but more things along the nature of like, okay, how much internet consumption should people like actually be exposed to for their own sanity? You know what I'm saying? I don't know like where the fine line is with rights or anything, but my point is merely that our generation has very much so been kind of like a guinea pig thrown into a world of just the internet and the results that, you know, proceed from that.
Well, I don't think you could do a like government limitation on people's time on the internet. I think that would go terribly. It has to be familial. It could be no like no kids under the age of 10 can have, like, could are allowed to have devices like that. Like, I could see that working. And, you know, parents who do give their kids that, they would be in trouble or something like that. And then at a certain point, like, maybe, I don't know, let's just say 12. Probably this is a bad number, but let's just say 12, you know, then it's allowed, but it, you know, parents are advised to keep their kids away from it. I don't know. Something like that.
Yeah.
What do you think of sort of the Gen Zers that have become Pope Francis, praisers?
Apologists. Yeah.
Well, they're not apologists because they don't really, or some of them may be apologists, but some of them just they think he's the most based Pope. I hope that it's like sarcasm, a meme, you know, that they're just showing or throwing around. But I think some of them are honest or honestly think that.
Yeah, no, it's a question I actually really like. So I have a video coming out in a few days. It's going to be premiering called Twitter Thomists, Catholic Influencers, and TikTok Apologists, The Problem with Catholic YouTube. And I touch a little bit upon this. And basically, I've seen, as you pointed out, there's this trend of Gen Z males particularly, who most of them, I would say, actually come out of Fuentes' movement, where they just think that Pope Francis is the most based Chad Pope of all time. And that, you know, if you can't see that everything he says is somehow Thomistic and in complete lockstep with Pope St. Pius X, then you're just an absolute idiot and should just never read theology again, right? That just kind of seems to be the attitude and moniker. I think that for a while, you do see, and from other Gen Zers that I've talked to, I do think that this tendency is born out of seeing a lot of, I would say, rightly bad takes that trad boomers give. So as an example, there's a lot of trad boomers who are newly traditionalists, or as I call them kind of like the Fox News Catholic conservatives, where they're like, St. John Paul the Great, he was the most amazing pope. He was the pope of my childhood. You know, he was amazing. He had everything together. I pray the Luminous Mysteries exclusively, just amazing.
Exclusively? That'd be kind of funny.
Yeah, but they're like those people. But then like Pope Francis, he's Bergoglio the anti-pope, and therefore he's the worst person ever. So you know what I'm saying? There's like that person. And if you're out there, I love you, right? There's no beef or anything. I love you. But my point is that, you know, a lot of these young guys are like, that's cringe. Like, that's a stupid take that you're making. And it's not based in, I would say, like, objective reality, etc. So you see this reaction. A lot of guys are like, okay, let's just be Pope Francis apologists, etc. But I think, though, when they get called to carpet by actual scholars, they start to change the moniker. So as an example, when I'm not going to name who it was, got into this particular spat because I don't want to bring controversy on your own channel. But let's just say there was another Thomist, if you will, a Twitter Thomist that's out there. And he was he got into a debate with Dr. Ed Fazer, right? When Fiducia came out. Dr. Ed Fazer is probably America's leading neo-scholastic. If you don't like Fazer, okay, don't like Fazer, but like he is an extremely intelligent scholar. And, you know, he is, we don't like after the council, we don't see any type of major Thomistic scholars, if you will, particularly a layman, right? Until fairly recently in these few decades, and one of them being Fazer. And so Fazer, he gives out a list of his criticisms. And then all of a sudden, you have a bunch of guys under the age of 25. Most of them probably don't have a bachelor's degree, who are all of a sudden in the Twitter comment section being like, oh, bro, absolutely cringe. Let me show you this like random obscure passage from one of St. Thomas's books, and let me show you how it works with this quotation from Pope Francis. And Fazer, interestingly enough, will engage them. And he'll work them down into a point where they'll say, well, when I say Pope Francis is super base, that's just a meme. That's just a joke that we have for boomers, etc. Maybe it was in the beginning, maybe it wasn't. But all I do know is that typically when they get into debates with very intelligent scholars, they seem to run from it. I'm not saying I'm one of those intelligent scholars. I'm not. I'm just an enjoyer of lively discussion and debate. But I've seen, for instance, like Dr. Fazer. I've also seen Father Thomas Crean. You should have him on your show. He's a traditional. You have? Oh, wonderful. Yeah, Father Thomas Crean, as you know, very intelligent neo-scholastic Dominican from England, written several books. And, you know, when they give, I would say, like, rational criticisms of the document, you know, they get absolutely lambasted by a bunch of these random Twitter users. And so I think that Gen Z, particularly the crowd that's in theology, I think one, what they need to do is take a humility pill and learn to chill. But also what I would, my encouragement to them would be is this. Theology is a science. It's a sacred science. It's a sacred science that you acquire a habit of and you learn from, but you learn from it not just by reading the textbooks of the science, manuals, scholastic commentators, the works of tradition, the patristics itself, the scriptures, of course, but it is also one that's born out of prayer in a sacred interior life. And when I observe a lot of the behavior of a lot of Gen Z, you know, if you will, Thomists online, they seem to me in many ways no better than like a lot of the right-wing memers who try to somehow like justify Adolf Hitler and the Catholic faith. I'm not saying they're in the same category, but I see the same spirit, if you will, there. It's just a young, immature, meme-ish spirit. There's nothing wrong with laughing. We all have an immature phase, of course, right? But my point is just to call people to a better behavior of recognizing like, hey, like you were talking about sacred stuff and you're just throwing it out on Twitter, right? So, you know, be careful about it. But that'd be my analysis. I think a lot of them, you know, it's a reaction. And then when they're called to the carpet, they'll just say it's a meme.
Yeah. As I've said, I'm not really a theology nerd. I'm not really, that's not my, place of study even, though I like reading when I have the time to do so. Tim Miller says, in my experience, the increasingly political left orientation of the church is turning away more and more young people. Yeah, I see that. Do you think that that the sort of online elements might be a somewhat of a cure to that, since there is a lot more online right-wing Catholicism, I guess?
Yeah, I would say I think it's a cure in one sense, and it can obviously be detrimental if used to an extreme. So in the sense that I think it's a cure, I think one, it will put you in touch with good other Catholics, and you should be proactive in things, for instance, like, okay, you know, there's all these problems, let me go seek out a good parish, you know, so maybe you find through watching Mass of the Ages, their website with all the Latin masses around the world, you know, something like that, you know, so you go and look for a good parish, you go and look for like-minded Catholics that can build you up. Where I think, of course, it can be detrimental is, as we talked about earlier, like focusing so much on the crisis, but not on interior life. But yeah, I would agree in general with Mr. Miller's statement. I do think that like you do see particularly higher up a lot of politically left wing clerics who don't hold the Catholic faith, who are trying to push the church in a direction. And I don't know if it pushes. I do think it pushes youth away, as we talked about, in the sense of a lot of them becoming Orthodox. But I do see a lot of youth pushing back against that, you know, and fighting for the faith inside of our own capacity.
I think we need a real reform of the, religious education.
Yeah, we need a major reform.
I've been teaching 6th and 7th grade religion at my local parish for the last 2 years. And, I mean, I'm definitely giving them information that they wouldn't hear from sort of their boomer teachers. Like, yes. But at the same time, the people over me are going to fall into a lot of the boomer belief systems. Because a lot of these leaders of these group of religious education tend to be women.
Yeah.
Which, you know, God love them for putting the effort and trying to build up the faithful, mm-hmm. but they tend to also be not qualified to be doing it. And they also bring a lot of sort of their, their biases to the table, which, I mean, it's not like I don't bring my biases to the table either, but I would say I'm fairly even-handed, even with things that are controversial to talk about. But, you know, and they're sort of more afraid of giving sort of what to them would be appearing to be the harsh answer to a question.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that the problem we have in the West and catechesis is you have, on the one hand, several generations of Catholics who have been uncatechized. So particularly since the 50s, you start to see catechism start to deteriorate a bit. But then after the council, you see it really pick up. So because of that, the result is that we have both teachers and students who don't know their faith. So my solution has always been, and this is one thing that I do at the parochial school that I teach at, the Catholic parochial school, is when I first showed up there, right, what we do is we have a program. So the priest is traditional. Most of the teachers are traditional. And when I showed up there 4 years ago, they started a program basically for kids from any parish, right, can come to the faith formation, basically catechism classes for free at the school, you know. And so what happened is all of these kids from Novus Ordo Paris showed up, and they had gone, you know, through, you know, years and years of formation maybe at their other parish. And these are, you know, middle schoolers and high schoolers. And I gave them all, and these are, you know, dozens of students, I gave them all basically like a survey quiz to see where you're at, you know, what, how much do you know? And these were questions like, can you list the Ten Commandments in order? Can you name the seven sacraments? Can you say the Apostles' Creed? Things like that. And the result was every student failed. Every student that wasn't a member of the school, right, who had come in had failed. And we had surveyed also like how involved they had been. And a lot of them had been involved for like 6-7 years, you know, in grade school in their faith formation program. Horrible result. And so I was like, okay, we need an overhaul. And so what we did was we said, we're going to go back to, and this is the model we use today, a Baltimore catechism strict model that you would have found in like pre-1920s America. So what we do is the students, again, depends on the grade, but let's just say you're a high schooler. You're required to memorize the entire Baltimore catechism, right? Question and answer, right? And so depending on the version you use, that can be anywhere from 420 questions up to 1400 questions and answers. And you're supposed to answer them completely in a test, as well as recite it to me and the priests, as well as to explain it in your own words. All right, explain it in your own words.
Okay.
It's been very successful. And so as an example, yesterday I was kind of giving some students a final, and it's just so funny seeing the reaction. So like I hand them, you know, basically their final and 300 questions for a final, like 300 questions, but I want to make sure they know their faith because we've been doing it wrong, you know, for a really long time. And so my whole point is, you know, so you got to give that to the students, but then you also got to take it for yourself. So if I was Pope, what I would do is I would completely redo education. I would say for priesthood and seminarians, you need to go back to the older model. The older model is infinitely better. You read any manual, any theology manual from the 50s going back, they are light years ahead of, and light years ahead in the sense of not just what they're talking about, but also their precision than anything that's being written today. Literally any Catholic work that's being written today. So go back and make them go through that as in philosophy and theology, and then in grade schools and Catholic schools, et cetera, Catholic colleges, make them memorize catechisms, but don't make it just rogue memorization. Like make them memorize the words because it's important to know the theological words, but then also make them explain it in their own words so that they know the concepts correctly. And I think what you'll do, what you will see as a result of that is separation of the goats and the sheep. Those who want to just make up their own faith will leave. And then those who are really interested will take root in that and they'll go forward.
Yeah. That's wonderful. I couldn't really do that in my situation working for a very Novus Ordo parish. But you know, that type of thing would have been lovely to do. I just tried to do something I wouldn't get fired for doing. Yeah,
exactly. When I first showed up and this first program started, man, I had multiple parents try to get me fired from the school. It would be over things like, you teach the children that people who die of unrepentant mortal sin go to hell. Or
I did do that.
Yeah. Like I have parents who like complain about that, or, you know, like, oh, you said homosexuality is a sin, you know, homosexual acts are a sin or something. Like, I mean, stuff like that where they're like, you know, oh, we don't like it. Or I remember one time I tried to get canceled because I gave a lecture on original sin. And they just didn't like that, you know? And so it's just, it's very funny. Most people who call themselves Catholic and are even, quote, in the church, you know, in the sense of practicing, don't believe in the Catholic faith. We need a major, major overhaul and a major, major restructuring of everything from the top to the bottom. And unfortunately, it's going to take a holy pope to do it. We can only do so much on our level, but it's really going to have to be some pope who comes in there and just cleans the house.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you know, this conversation has been absolutely awesome. I really enjoyed talking to you, Nick. You know, a lot of this is, you know, great inspiration for my upcoming series on sort of counter-revolutionary stories. Sort of, I really want to give young Catholics a sort of political example to follow and to mirror, and especially the beliefs that come along with that. So we do have a answer, and that people aren't just jumping over to National Socialism. So look out for more of that. There'll be interviews within that. Even my interview 2 days ago with Taylor Marshall even kind of touched on it. So I put it in sort of the playlist that I'm making. I'll check that episode out on St. George and the Dragon. That was a lot of fun. And also I will be on this guy named AI Shire Tories channel in like at 3 p.m. We're going through sort of a book about the destruction, the end of the British Empire, and the history behind that. So, and he, you know, he's a Protestant, in England, and, he recently bought, the Habsburg Way.
Mm.
So I'm very interested to see where that goes. Anyways, so if you're interested in any of those things, stick around in my channel and go to AI Shire Tory for that. For the episode that I'm doing in a few hours with him. Nick, tell people where they can find you, and tell us what you're doing the rest of the week or next week.
Yeah, so people can find me over here on YouTube. Just type in The Traditional Thomist. You'll find me smoking a pipe over there and talking about all kinds of areas of theology. Mainly what we've been focusing on at the moment is a series called The Problem with the Novus Ordo Mass. And it's basically an in-depth series where I examine the two missals that are used, the traditional missal, the new missal, and I go and I show from their own sources, as well as with various other textbooks, etc., kind of the new orientation that is in the Mass. So if you're wanting kind of like an actual academic and scholarly presentation of the problems with the new Mass, as opposed to just kind of maybe a cringe, you know, compilation video of Clown Mass versus Solemn High or something like that. It's like, if you're looking for a scholarly reason of why there's issues, go check that out. But then after that series is done, I'm mainly going to be focusing in on Thomism proper, Scholasticism, getting into dogmatics and moral theology. So people can find me there. They can also find me over on Instagram. You can check out The Traditional Thomist. I post somewhat sparingly over there, but I'm going to be doing a lot more kind of in the upcoming realm over there. And so, yeah, check me out on both places. And of course, you can see me fairly commonly on The Meaning of Catholic, which is another YouTube show, as well as I'm kind of like the unofficial third co-host for Avoiding Babylon, because I've been on like 50 times now.
Yes, but you are.
Those are great guys.
You're the Gen Z voice.
I am. I'm the Gen Z voice. And I think they're both like Gen X or something like that. So.
Well, I think Rob's millennial.
I think you're right, actually. Yeah, I feel like you told me that once. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Check all those things out. I have a link in the description for The Traditional Thomist YouTube channel. So check that all out. Thank you all for watching. Please like, share, comment, and subscribe. Anything to say before we go, Nick?
Just keep the faith, people. Focus in on the interior life, and you'll be fine.
God bless everyone. Bye.